Trendstorm.
Welcome to Radio Sputnik and Trendstorm. My name is Andrew Kripko, and I'm going to give you a forward-focused analysis of things to come and the general trends behind them. Here's what we have for you today. March of Return. Has the Third Intifada finally arrived? Palestine's March of Return descended into bloodshed after Israel shot scores of unarmed protesters that advanced towards the border, pouring fuel on the fire of what might turn out to finally be the Third Intifada that's been talked about for a few months already. USA migrant crisis. Will the caravan derail the DACA deal? The inaction of the Mexican authorities to the massive caravan of Central American migrants that's snaking through their country en route to the U.S. is being seen by Trump as evidence that the DACA deal is doomed. And also, Syrian peace, tying up loose ends. The Ankara summit between the presidents of Russia, Iran, and Turkey aimed to tie up the loose ends of the Syrian conflict and advance a political solution to the long-running war. Opening up this edition of Trendstorm are the latest Israeli-Palestinian tensions. Palestine's March of Return descended into bloodshed after Israel shot scores of unarmed protesters that advanced towards the border, pouring fuel on the fire of what might turn out to finally be the Third Intifada that's been talked about for a few months already. Hamas called for a Third Intifada back in December after Trump recognized the entirety of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. But apart from a symbolic meeting of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the highly publicized arrest of Ahed Tamimi, there wasn't much a show for this latest rebellion. Until now. That changed just the other day when thousands of Palestinians were mobilized to march on the border during what they regard as Land Day in order to demand that they be allowed to return to their homes after the forced 1948 expulsion that they call the Nakba, to which Israel responded by deploying troops, snipers, and drones in killing over a dozen of them who ventured too close to the frontier and injuring hundreds more in the process. Israel has since rejected all calls for an international investigation and refuses to take responsibility for what happened, justifying its actions on the basis of securing the border. The Palestinians are outraged by Israel's nonchalant attitude towards these killings, but found some consolation in the widespread support for their cause, with Turkish President Erdogan being the most vocal in this respect after reigniting his war of words with Netanyahu by once again calling him a terrorist. The gung-ho backing of the Palestinians by Turkey and many other Muslim countries, aside from most notably Saudi Arabia, contrasts with the more measured response of Russia, which called on both Palestine and Israel to exercise restraint and prevent actions that can cause innocent people to suffer. Despite Moscow offering to host talks between the Palestinian and Israeli authorities and hopefully advancing a political solution to the long-running conflict, it might be unable to stop the Third Intifada that already looks to have begun and which might climax during the upcoming inauguration of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem sometime next month. If the conflict continues to escalate, then the March of Return might bring Palestine and Israel to the point of no return, beyond which any prospects, once again for peace, might become impossible for the foreseeable future. All right, folks, so this is definitely a very emotional issue, and it is probably the most important one in the Mideast, not only today, but over the past 7 decades. So we're going to start off our conversation by speaking to Mr. Feroz Mithy Borwala. He is the founder and National General Secretary of the India-Palestine Solidarity Forum.
Trendstorm.
Okay, Feroz, Hamas first declared a Third Intifada at the end of last year, but it's only now that Palestinians are organizing en masse and on the brink of a full-blown rebellion yet again. So why did it take nearly 4 months to get to this point? And Feroz, how much further do you expect the March of Return protest to go?
Basically, the Palestinian issue went to the back burner, and the struggles carried on within Palestine at smaller localized levels, but nothing national was emerging. And what has actually happened that there are two things happening at the same time. One is the result of the Syrian war is open for all to see that the government of Syria, the Syrian people, the Syrian army is winning the war. That is coming to an end in its own way. And at the same time, the Trump declaration on Jerusalem in December, that has again awakened the Palestinian people, the Palestinian solidarity movement across the world, and has brought Palestine back to the number one international issue. So that has slowly begun to galvanize the Palestinian masses from below. And the Palestinians, I believe at this time, lack a strong national leadership that can give them a sense of direction and can lead the way. But what has happened is that the Palestinian movement has now re-emerged, especially around the issue of Jerusalem, and the people are beginning to march again. And I think what happened on the 30th of March, the land day, when 30,000 people marched to the borders, unarmed, not a stone in the hand, not a gun, not anything at all. This was, this is the way Mahatma Gandhi has always led his marches, and this is the way, I think this is also the nightmare for the Israelis. Today there are 30,000 Palestinians who marched, 17 got killed, 1,500 injured. This has given a lot of bad press across the world, not that Israel is scared, but this has definitely created more and more sympathy for the Palestinian cause, more and more support for the Palestinians across the world, even more so within Western societies, I believe. Now, today you have 30,000, tomorrow it could be 300,000, after that 3 million, 5 million. And the nightmare for the Israelis is that if you have these masses marching from Gaza to the, from all within historic Palestine, and you have people marching in from Lebanon and from Jordan and from Syria, and the refugees marching from across the borders, how many can they kill? How many bombs can they drop from the air?
Yeah, that's actually what I wanted to ask you about, Feroz. Israel has proven that it has no reservations about using deadly force to protect what it considers to be its border with Palestine. But as you said, how many people are they going to kill? How many people can actually get shot marching on what they consider to be the border? By they, I mean Israel in this case. So, just all in all, Feroz, how do the Palestinians expect to guarantee their right to return if they're unable to cross the frontier and physically reclaim their land? If I understand you properly, then what you're inferring is that, the Palestinians can almost overwhelm the Israeli forces. Is that it, or do they have something else in mind?
Well, basically, telling you from my own discussion that we've had with Palestinians during the two convoys, the one to Gaza and then especially the one to Jerusalem, where we were clearly saying that the day will come when the Palestinians will be marching back home across the borders. Okay, they'll be facing Israeli bullets. They'll be maybe facing Israeli bombs dropped from the air, but how many can be killed is a big issue. When will the Israeli public awaken? When will the Israeli military, its pilots awaken? And as we know, there are already a lot of resistors within the Israeli armed forces. But when will the conscience of the Israelis, their hearts turn and stop these massacres of the Palestinians? So we need to see where the strategy is going, because the marches are coming in from Gaza. As it is now, even more than, I think 44% of Gaza has been again taken over by the Israelis. They've been squeezing even what is left of little Gaza. But the 30th of March has been a major turning point. Definitely the Palestinians have a bigger plan. They've not just gone randomly marching on the 30th of March. They have a larger plan unfolding, leading to the Nakba on the 15th of May. So we need to see where it is all leading. And more importantly, as important is the solidarity movement as to how we perceive this and what are we going to do in the weeks to come to support them.
Yeah, these are very important issues. Now, Feroz, the last thing I want to talk with you about today is how Israel has ruled out a neutral third-party investigation into the latest killings and is once again going it alone by shunning the UN. But what are the prospects that a responsible international actor such as Russia could breathe new life into the peace process? Or do you think that the conflict has moved well past the point of no return?
Basically, Israel will never agree to an independent international, any kind of investigation into the matter. We know what the Israelis are all about. They don't care for the United Nations. They don't care for any international bodies or institutions. They are a law to their own self. They are the chosen people, they believe so. For them also, it doesn't matter. I believe Russia should be playing a larger role, a much, much larger role than they have in this entire, to actually sort out the Israel-Palestine issue. Because the Americans certainly are not capable of it. Trump has proved that. Time and time, every American government has proved that they're not capable of being a neutral, fair, interlocutor to sort out the entire problem. If Russia and China actually come into play in a large way, because now they are, in fact, Russia is now the most important player in the region. Americans are slowly being driven out. They have some idiots like the Saudis and UAE and all these governments they're in contact with. But the Russians are now in alliance with Turkey, with Iran. Even the other countries in the region have realized that they have to talk to Russia now. So if Russia plays a role in Palestine, and also what is important is a large Russian Jewish community in Israel. Now that has to, so Russia has its own ways of dealing with it. Unfortunately, the Russian Jews are very, very Zionist and very, you know, I mean, they're very extreme, the kind of Liebermans and all that we have over there. And moreover, I think Russia has had its own problems of dealing with the Zionist lobby within Russia, which Putin dealt with when he came to power in 2000. So now what we need to also worry about is the way the Zionists have strangled the Americans and the Canadians and the Europeans. Will they be, I'm sure they have plans to do the same in Russia. And from what I understand is Putin definitely knows what is happening. But then there is the Medvedev lobby within Moscow that has its own weaknesses towards the international Zionist lobby.
Feroz, thanks for adding some crucial context to the March of Return and sharing your forecast with us about the Third Intifada. Now we're going to hear what Mr. Corey DuPont has to say. Corey is an American independent researcher and historian with degrees in theology and history.
Trendstorm.
Okay, Corey, how influential will foreign moral and political support, especially from Iran and Turkey, be in determining whether the March of Return transforms into a Third Intifada?
You know, it will be interesting because there's already this tension there in terms of the relationships between these countries in that region. So with a shift, for example, that almost took place between Hamas going into the arms of Saudi Arabia, but now there seems to be this sort of going back now to Iran. It will be interesting to see how that plays out because there are already stakes involved between these countries in Syria, for example. It's interesting. There's a lot of it that's up in the air that I can't really speculate with any certainty as to what will happen.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of different moving parts behind the scenes. But I'd like to ask you a little bit more about Hamas. You know, you brought up how it at one time it seemed to be in the Saudi camp. Now it's kind of moving towards the Iranian Turkish one. What do you think made it want to pivot like this? Because I mean, that is kind of a profound shift given contemporary Mideast geopolitics.
It is. It was really, I think it was unprecedented because, you know, traditionally, the Saudis have always had this peculiar relationship with the state of Israel. So when Hamas, for a brief moment, considered swinging towards Saudi Arabia, it took me by surprise, as I'm sure it did many others, because I'm not exactly sure what it would stand to gain from that relationship. And of course, you have the U.S. as sort of this mitigating partner between Israel and Saudi Arabia. It has a bizarre relationship with both countries. And we know Hamas, for example, is very critical of U.S. policy in the area of Palestine and Israel. So I'm not exactly sure, you know, where this was coming from. But what's interesting, too, I think, is that there's this talk going on, and you might know more about it than I do at this point. But there was this discussion going on about a peace plan coming out of the White House, in saying that it was possible that a future peace conference could take place somewhere in the Middle East, possibly even Cairo. Personally, I think it might be more beneficial for such a conference to take place elsewhere, perhaps even in Tehran. But we know that the Trump administration's aversion to all things Iranian just wouldn't make that happen. But imagine if it could. I mean, it could transform the region for the better in all sorts of ways. But, you know, Hamas, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm grateful, I think, that Hamas is moving back toward the Iranian sphere. It certainly adds a balance to the region, I think, that Hamas going towards Saudi Arabia, I don't see how that would work out. But
okay, well, what I want to ask you about then, since, you know, we're discussing Saudi Arabia and everything, is what do you make out of its very close relationship with Israel under Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman? I mean, he lately said that the Jewish people have a right to a nation state in at least part of their ancestral homeland. I mean, this is seen as pretty unprecedented. And we know, of course, that, you know, Saudi Arabia is involved with the Trump administration's speculated peace plan for the region. So what role could the kingdom play in averting a third intifada on behalf of its Israeli partner?
Oh, yeah. I feel like we're starting to enter into the Trump boardroom. We know that Saudi Arabia now has these new arrangements with the United States, which was not a welcome development for people who voted for Trump, obviously, including myself. But it'll be interesting to see where this goes, because Saudi Arabia is sort of that classic enigma that's wrapped inside a riddle. We never really know what its intentions are if we look at the theological underpinnings, I think, of this conflict, which obviously go back centuries, there's no real reason to believe that Saudi Arabia would have any reason to want to have a positive relationship with Israel, because it seems to go against the established doctrine. But I can't see how this is all going to pan out, because ultimately the state of Israel and Saudi Arabia, I think, ultimately have two very different goals, because they have two very different worldviews, I think, of the region. But there's a lot, obviously, that's going on behind closed doors that we don't really know about yet. So I'm not really sure how that will play out. It's all very peculiar to me. You know, Donald Trump's policy in the Middle East has certainly broke many norms. But at the same time, I think it's also continuing certain old trends as well. I mean, for example, I was not surprised to find out that this so-called peace process that's being considered in the White House is actually being overseen by Jared Kushner. I don't know exactly how that's going to work out for Palestinians, because we obviously know all the different worldviews that are involved here. So,
okay, well, you know, I want to ask you more about Trump and his policy. I mean, it seems like, you know, no one's really been able to define what we can call a Trump doctrine. But if we just look over the past year at the impact that Donald Trump has had on the Mideast, and specifically on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, how would you assess it, and where do you forecast it heading? I mean, if we could just speak more in general terms, do you think he's contributing to more destabilization, or do you think this possible peace plan, you know, he might be able to pull it off in some way? And if so, what would it have to entail?
Well, I mean, it really is two different questions, isn't it? Whether or not he's going to pull off anything in terms of foreign policy, I think he's handicapped himself by bringing on certain folks that traditionally in the past have been, I think, a cancer on U.S. foreign policy, such as John Bolton. I mean, we know people like John Bolton, for example, don't want to see really a change of the status quo in the Middle East. I think most people like this are content to maintain that status quo of America having this greater war for the Middle East, right? As Andrew Bacevich probably would recognize it. I voted for Trump, for example, largely because he ran on a fairly non-interventionist foreign policy platform, which was a breath of fresh air. But at the same time, while I think things could be much worse, because we still don't really technically have boots on the ground in mass, for example, in any country. So that's good. That certainly would not have been the case had his opposition won. But I'm not entirely enthusiastic with, obviously, his choice of wanting to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. I think it would have been probably more prudent to have a peace plan in the works first and then discuss the possible relocation of a U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. That would have made more sense. But by deciding to take the U.S. Embassy and move it to Jerusalem eventually before there's even a peace plan in process, that makes absolutely no sense to me. I don't see how that logically is going to work out. You've already sabotaged the process because one side is not going to come to the table. I mean, Mahmoud Abbas, for example, has been very consistent in not wanting to meet with any representatives of the United States, even Vice President Mike Pence. So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. I don't really know. Donald Trump wants to change the direction of U.S. policy in the Middle East. I really have a difficult time understanding how certain state actors, for example, in the United States, are going to allow this to happen. Yeah, I would hope for the best. I really do. But I don't see how that's going to happen. I mean, there's this constant push to kill the Iran deal, which I think was probably one of the better aspects to come out of Obama's foreign policy. But we'll see what happens. We'll see.
Corey, thanks for helping us understand what might be going on behind closed doors and laying the groundwork for either a third intifada or an unprecedented peace, with it likely being one or the other outcomes at the end of the day.
Trendstorm.
Now, folks, if we reflect back on what both Feroz and Corey share with us today, we can see that, of course, what's happening in Palestine, it's not unexpected. This problem has been ongoing for decades already. But we do see that this march of return might actually be heralding in a third intifada. Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel definitely set off a lot of anger in Palestine, and with good reason. And it actually seems to have been this event, more so than anything else in recent years, which is laying the groundwork for a third intifada. And if this rebellion comes to pass, then for sure, the prospects for peace can definitely be ruled out for the indefinite future. So folks, if you want to sound off and share what you think about this, please send us an email at radio@sputniknews.com or find us on Facebook. Stay with us.